is SiriusXM Doctor Radio.
From the heart of the NYU Langone Medical Center, this is About Our Kids.
Welcome. You are listening to Dr. Radio, SiriusXM 110. My name is Lori Evans. I am joined today by my special co-host, Lauren Donnelly, who is joining me from the NYU Child Study Center, where she is a clinical assistant professor in the Department of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. She specializes in working with children, teens, and young adults who are on the autism spectrum. Good morning, Lauren.
Good morning, Lori.
We are so excited. Let me explain why. Because we are doing like lots of Halloween fears and scary things, and we have to get on the train really early. And so normally we don't meet our guests on the train really early, but I met our very special surprise guest who just popped up on the train at like before 7 in the morning.
That happens in New York.
I have nothing else to do.
Right, because, you know, sleep, come on. We have our special guest in studio, Dr. Anna Maria Albano, who is a professor of medical psychology in psychiatry at Columbia University Medical Center. I have to stumble over all of her titles. She's board certified in clinical child and adolescent psychology. She is the director of the Columbia University Clinic for Anxiety and Related Disorders, informally known as QCARD, the clinical director of the NYPH Youth Anxiety Center at QCARD, and editor of the Evidence-Based Practice in Child and Adolescent Mental Health Journal. That's enough. I can breathe.
Good morning. It is so exciting because
if we're talking anxiety, she is one of the people that we need to have. Also joined by phone, we have Dr. Karen Levine, who is a developmental psychologist at Helping Children with Challenges in Lexington, Massachusetts. She works with children who have developmental or social or emotional challenges. She's a lecturer on psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and was the co-founder and co-director of the Boston Children's Hospital Autism Program in the late 1980s. She was probably in kindergarten at the time. She's also written lots of books. One, Attacking Anxiety, a Step-by-Step Guide, Treatment Planning for Children on the Autism Spectrum, and Replays, Using Play to Enhance Emotional and Behavioral Development for Children with Autism Spectrum Disorders. Welcome, Dr. Levine.
Hi, welcome. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you just fine. We are very excited. So we want people to give us a call. You can start out if you are worried about this upcoming holiday of Halloween, which we kind of think is a fun holiday.
Right.
You know, and maybe Anne Marie will tell us how she tortured her sister on
Halloween.
But that's okay. Yeah. We can be reached at 1-877-NYU-DOCS. That's 1-877-698-3627. Dr. Levine, why don't I start with you? Because, you know, we think of Halloween pleasurable, fun, we dress up. What are some of the things that when we talk about kids who are on the spectrum, what are the specific things that we worry about, you know, with this holiday?
Well, like a lot of little kids, a lot of kids on the autism spectrum are terrified of things like masks
mm-hmm.
or things suddenly looking different. Or could even be crowds of kids coming to the door yelling trick or treat. There are a lot of different aspects of it that can be really scary. And for a verbal, typically developing kid, you can kind of explain it. It's all pretend. This is what we do. And they may naturally catch on. But a child with autism may not have the language to understand. They may not understand the pretend as well. So it may really seem like real monsters. And they may not know as much to look to the adult. Oh, is the adult scared? No, they seem okay, so I'll be okay. To do that kind of nonverbal co-regulating can be much harder.
Right. And I think, Anne-Marie, how common is it, even in kids who aren't on the spectrum, to have some fears around, you know, this time of year or, you know, in the city, we have these huge parades, both in neighborhoods like in Brooklyn or also in Manhattan. These are big parades with people dressed in all sorts of scary ways?
Yeah. Well, that's the typical day on the subway. But fears of costume characters, mask, people with face paint and such, these are among the most common fears in typically developing children. And also then we see specific phobias of costume characters are quite common in young children too. And I clearly remember a most articulate 6-year-old, a lovely child who came into my office when I was here with you at NYU, who, despite the fact that her parents from the time she was three tried to engage people to show her that they put on face makeup and this and that, she could not deal with Halloween-related stuff, costume characters, birthday parties where a clown was coming, anything like that. So it's for kids who are typically developing too, it's very hard even to see someone transition into putting these costumes on, because that developmental stage of early childhood, they're straddling concrete thinking and then into more flexible thinking about what's real and unreal.
Right, like I remember even when I was younger, we would go trick-or-treating and lived in the suburbs, and my piano teacher, her house, she dressed up as a witch. I never wanted to go back to piano. Or maybe that was an excuse. I'm not sure. But it was. She was so realistic and so scary that I was convinced the next time that that's how she would answer the door. So,
and that sounds pretty unexpected, too. I was on the street yesterday and someone was dressed up. So Halloween's not until next week. But all of a sudden, someone was walking down the street and they had those kind of paint on stickers where it looks like someone is bleeding or there's gore. So it seems like part of it might be really difficult to prepare children for if there's those unexpected pieces of it as well.
Right. And it used to be we had Halloween. Now we have Halloween season.
Right.
So it's drawn out even longer for kids.
So, Emory, why don't we start at the beginning? So someone comes and their parents are telling you that they're afraid of some of the things around Halloween and they want them to be able to enjoy trick-or-treating. How do you start with someone who maybe isn't on the spectrum? What would you recommend?
Well, what we're going to do, of course, is do an assessment to see, is this a typically occurring fear that's something that is very transient and light? Is it, how much does it interfere with the child's daily life? And, for example, the child I just described at six, she couldn't go to a birthday party without the parents calling ahead to see if there were costume characters that would be there. She couldn't go to Disney World or anything like that. And this little one sat in my office, and her parents worked in a medical field, and she looked at me and she said, could you give me a pill to get rid of this? So it was really interfering in the child's life. She couldn't have a normal day in the same way that typical kids do. So that's right. The one thing we have to look at. How much does it interfere? And then, much like what you read about in the books that Dr. Levine has written and others, is that, you know, we have to do a graduated approach that meets the child at their level of understanding in a step-by-step way. But what has to happen is consistency. The parents need to be on board to follow the program all the way through. These parents did as much as they could to try and get her to look at things and see things, but it wasn't consistent. Mm-hmm. You know, there were times they're tired or they're too busy or something just happens out of surprise. So we have to do it in a more consistent manner when the kids are young.
So let's think about that. It's also, I think what happens is parents, when we talk about anxiety or fears, they'll say, oh, Halloween, who cares? We'll just stay inside. You know, we just won't participate. It's one day. It's not a big deal. Is that something either of you, Dr. Levine, would you recommend? Like, is avoidance okay since it's one day?
Like you all were saying there, it used to be you could kind of do that. You know, there was a day, but now it's like a Halloween season. You go into Stop and Shop or the store or the street and there are people in costumes everywhere. And it can be, you know, like you were afraid of your piano teacher, you can become afraid of going to the store or going out in the street. So because these fears and phobias can spread so much, we generally recommend working on them. I sometimes call it the desert island test. If you feel like you want to grab your family and go to a desert island for October, it's probably worth working on. And there are lots of fun ways to work on these things in baby step by steps, and you can really make progress, and it can be very empowering for parents and fun for kids if you put in a lot of humor and playfulness and see your child make headway and be comfortable and happy with things that used to scare them.
So talk to us a little bit about using humor, because you focus on that a great deal.
And again, you can't do this with all kids, but lots of kids, you can kind of figure out what's funny to them. Watch them playing with their siblings or their parents and figure out what's funny. And then, like, I was working with one child who was terrified of math. So we started out with paper, holes in paper, and every time I held up the paper, I would pretend I was about to sneeze. Achoo! And then we moved into Spider-Man masks and Darth Vader masks, and I do the same ha-choo, or sometimes I burp or moo when I put it on my face, and I pull it down right away. And he thought that was really funny, and then he'd do that, and I'd pretend to be afraid. So we added funny sounds, we added funny noises. When I pretended to be that my character was afraid, I had my character leap into the trash bin in my office, and he thought that was really funny. Sometimes you can use
you must have a big trash bin. No,
I have a big trash bin. Exactly. Yeah. So as long as you can, you know, your early morning audience may not find that hysterical, but he was rolling around laughing and wanting me to do it again and again, and each time he was getting a little more, you know, as Dr. Albano said, a little more exposure to the scary trigger of the mask with each time we did this, and we used a bunch of different masks. And then we brought in his mother, and she was able to do it in a way that was relaxing and fun for her, too, because it can be very anxiety-provoking to see your child scared, but there he was laughing with the mask. So that made it fun for her, too.
You know what I really like about what you said is what child therapists do so well is relating to the child in a way that they understand, and that gets into what is in their worldview. So if humor, if Spider-Man, if making noises and funny sounds and things like that, if that is what they relate to, that's how we have to meet them. And sometimes, as you're saying, we have to help parents to see that, and teachers and others who are with the child on a daily basis. And it's not for any criticism. It's that they may be so concerned about how to help the child, they sort of know what, from an adult perspective, we need to do, but we have to get into the child's mind and work through the child's way of seeing the world to help this turn around for them.
Right, and I think that's, talk to us a little bit about the overarching, what you guys are talking about is graduated exposures and doing hierarchies, because when you walk into any therapist's office, like I have lots of playful stuff in my office, and people say, oh, are you playing with the child? And I'm like, no, not in the way you think, because they've had therapy where, oh, okay, they'll just play. So how is this different? Emery's making faces. Okay.
How do we start?
All right, go ahead.
Yeah, okay, well, ahead. You know, I do think it's important that parents know this and know that there's a difference between just play and a difference between play as a procedure and tool of cognitive behavioral and behavioral therapies of ABA or things, you know, things that we're doing to help our kids. So number one is, the first thing to know is there's got to be goals related to it. Why is the child here? What are we working on? And then what does the child relate to? What activities do they enjoy? What medium, whether it's art, crafts, drama, different things that may be helpful to help them express themselves and then learn concepts about things like facing fears. And so the therapist is going to use play activity to facilitate, first of all, a therapeutic relationship, so getting to know the child and know about one another. And then the next thing is to build trust, mm-hmm. right? So if you sit with the child and the child is building blocks and playing with that, you don't want to redirect them. You don't want to try to say, well, come on, let's talk. No, you just play along with the blocks with them. You let them take the lead. And then over time, what you're doing is using whatever play materials to help them to create scenarios and situations that are difficult for them, and working them toward teaching them problem solving and doing the exposure, as we're saying, exposing them to some of the scenes, like through doll play or puppets. You know, one puppet is afraid, a scaredy cat, the other puppet is more of the brave cat, you know, and how they help one another. So it's in that way. It's directive.
Right.
Then it becomes directive. It's not just sit back and interpret. It really is having to get in there with the child in a real trusting way and then help direct them and help shape them towards internalizing for them coping strategies.
Right, and I think that is the key, that people understand that even when, yes, of course they're kids, I'm not going to sit in a sterile room with just me and the child and my chart on, like, things that we're going to expose them
my
to.
My adult patients get bored with that,
well,
too. Though,
I say all the time, whenever I have families in my office, the people who are playing with my fidgets more, the parents,
right.
You know, and the kids like to make fun of them and say, see, you have to do it too. You do it too. But I think it's that idea that we're using it as a medium, not in and of itself.
Right.
Because I think we've all had kids who come to us who've had these fears for a long time, and yes, they might have been even in treatment, and they're just talking about it, okay, or maybe they're not even talking about it. So, Dr. Levine, how do you kind of help parents understand that we are going to, in some ways, scare your kids too, because I think parents are worried about that, especially kids on the autism spectrum. We don't want to get them upset.
Right. Well, one thing I try to do, particularly for kids who have less language and I can do less talking about it, I'll check in a lot with the parents. It's like, is it okay if I try using this math? You think mm-hmm. they'll be scared if I try doing this? So we really work as a team. And I do say, you know, I may miss and I may go too fast or too far, but I'll go right back and fix it and make sure we're all okay. I use a lot of enticing, so I try to get it so the kids are begging me to do more. Do it again, and then I might move up the ladder a little bit and do it again with a tiny bit scarier math, but the same really fun, playful interaction. So we build an interaction or a game or a playfulness that the child likes, that the parent understands and enjoys, and then we add more and more exposure within that frame so the child's comfortable and having a good time. Most kids find it really fun, amazingly enough, working on this kind of stuff bit by bit by bit, because you try not to move so fast that they get freaked out.
And I think that's key. I want to come back to that. I just also want to let our listeners know that our phone lines are open and we want to hear from you. Maybe you've had a child who's really scared or fearful during this season, as we now call it. Maybe they're afraid of spiders, do that all the time. You know, witches, ghosts, and how maybe they've helped their child cope. Give us a call. We can be reached at 1-877-NYU-DOCS. That's 877-698-3627. Lauren, you started to talk and I interrupted you.
Dr. Levine, I'm wondering if you could give us an example of that graded exposure. We're talking about it a little bit abstractly, just so that people that are listening might be able to understand that a little bit better. How do we start
sure.
and build up to what the fear actually is?
Sure. So let's say I had a child afraid of all kinds of bugs, including spiders. So we started off, I would draw a little bug on a page, and it was really just kind of a X with a few more X's. And I'd say, oh, that's a bug. And he would be afraid just because I would label that as a bug. So we started, I would just draw a line and say that was a bug, a dot and say it was a bug. And he'd be like, no bug. Like, that wasn't a bug. He knew that wasn't. And then we'd add a few more steps, and I'd pretend to be afraid. So the gradual exposure started with just a dot on a page, and gradually we worked up to looking at drawings on my computer. You know, there's nothing better than like Google Images or YouTube for finding examples that you can move up a fear ladder. And I say, is this one okay? No, not that one. Is this one okay? No, not that one. Kind of like you're at the eye doctor, you know, is this better? Is this better? but each time I would show him something, we were looking together. From his perspective, we were just kind of judging them. But meanwhile, he was getting more and more exposure to different pictures. And I had some that were more realistic, and we gradually moved up to little videos. They're great videos on YouTube of, you know, spiders eating out of their owner's hands and all that kind of stuff. So we find, I couldn't find an actual spider, but we found some bugs in the roof of, in the ceiling outside our roof at the office, and more stuff at home, and toy spiders. We also used plastic bugs. So we used all kinds of things that replicated different parts of the spiders. I wasn't sure what aspect of it that was scary for him. I think he was also, like most kids, afraid of feeling afraid. So we worked a lot on pretend afraid. He would scare me with them with the plastic bugs. I would scare him with them. So we worked on the surprise element, having them appear where you didn't expect them, you know, throwing sticky ones on the wall, having them appear behind the couch, that kind of thing, and pretending to be scared with more and more of a surprise element there.
All right. Because you said something that I think is key, and I'd like to hear Dr. Albano, is that some people are afraid of just even feeling that feeling of being afraid. How do you help them with that?
That's actually, you're right on. I mean, I had a big smile when you said that, Dr. Levine, because the fear of fear happens very quickly, that kids learn to be afraid of the internal uh-oh sensation. So whatever we're talking about, whether the teacher is saying, take out your, clear your desk and take out a piece of paper, uh-oh, a test. They may feel it as something in their stomach, or they might get a, you know, deep breath or something all of a sudden. Somebody startles you, that fear that you have, that jumping and the adrenaline rush. Those kinds of internal sensations are associated with anxiety. They're associated with surprise. They're associated with anger, many different types of feelings. But kids very quickly become labeling their internal sensations as anxiety. You know, this is, I'm afraid, this can hurt me, this is something I can't handle. So when they get the littlest twinge, whether it's walking down the street and they hear a buzz, ooh, mm-hmm. that could be a bee, you know, a little twinge from that hearing the buzz all of a sudden is, I'm in a swarm of bees, but there's nothing around. You know, so it's so we have to help kids. This is like part one, and I'm sure you do this with children on the spectrum. Part one of our work is always about recognizing feelings in our body and learning how to let them go. And with children with the spectrum, on the spectrum that I've worked with, we have the Let Go song. We sing Let It Go and things like that, right? To try and work with that. And then also do some relaxation, some breathing, some mindfulness, just to help them experience and learn to sort of ride the wave of whatever that initial feeling is. Ride the wave, because it usually passes, and then you recognize, wait, what is this actually? I can handle where I am.
Right. I always laugh because I had this young girl whose father was really great to work with, and she was afraid of lots of things. She was on the spectrum, and her father just said, look, I think I've got it. This is the technique we're going to use. And I said, okay, fine. What do you think? And he's like, this is going to be the do nothing. We are going to sit here quietly and do absolutely nothing. And she's like, oh, I think it's getting better. We just need to do nothing for a little while longer. And that concept of that, this, no matter how strong the feeling is, we can wait it out. And that's, you know, she's like, so she would come into my office and say, do nothing today. You know, and I was like, yeah, you're going to pay me for that. It's good, you know. But that idea of just riding the wave, that this is a strong sensation.
Let me just give another example, too, because a lot of times what happens when kids wake up in the middle of the night and they go running into their parents' room, mm-hmm. is they wake up in the middle of the night and something woke them up, whatever it was. It might have been a change in their internal state, maybe a noise, or they just naturally wake up. They go running into the parents' room right away. Just building on what you said, I had this little boy who did this every night after night after night, and he was afraid. He lived on like the 20-something floor on a building here in New York City. He was afraid someone was going to come in through the window. Okay. right. But I said, let's do this. Tonight, when you go home, and every night this week until I see you again, when you wake up, instead of running into your parents' room, here I gave him a bunch of paper and a pencil. I said, I want you to write down each night on the paper what actually happens. Mm-hmm. Wait. See what happens, write it down, then run in your parents' room. Mm-hmm. He came in the next week, and he looks at me, a little guy, and he said, it didn't work. And I said, and I'm thinking to myself, okay, it didn't work. I said, oh, all right, I'm sorry, you went running into your mom's room? He said, no, I kept falling back asleep. And then he said, I know what you did. And so, you know, and it is this waiting it out. He just needed to wait to fall back to sleep.
Sometimes kids on the autism spectrum, because you can't explain to them as well what they're doing, if they don't have enough language, you can more hit the ground running. You can more start in with getting them in a real playful, relaxed mood, and then do the gradual exposures, dropping it into the session. What's wonderful about treating fears and phobias is you don't need a lot of language to do it. For kids who have language, mm-hmm. you can capitalize on it, but you don't really need it to do this kind of work with kids.
So how might you then recognize for some of the children that are on the spectrum, maybe not using as much language, can't articulate the same way, how would you start to recognize that, what is the fear, and help the parents to recognize that?
Well, usually parents are very articulate about what their kid is afraid of. You know, like, I can't go into the store because they scream whenever we see a blah, blah, whatever it is.
Right.
Or, you know, these are the things we can't do. Usually families' lives are quite ruled by these kinds of fears. You know, we can't go to family gatherings because they're afraid of cakes or singing or whatever it is, family birthday parties. So parents are usually really articulate about what it is, and I try to drill deep to get as much information as I can about that before I start working with a child who isn't going to be able to tell me about it as much. And then I work stepwise, like, is it, you know, is it what they see, what they smell, the whole thing, the fear of fear? Sometimes we don't know exactly, so we just sort of unbundle the whole ball of wax that's scary for the child, and bit by bit do these gradual exposures one piece at a time.
Because I think whether kids are on this spectrum or not, one of the most common things, and we certainly see it on Halloween, because Halloween activities often go into the evening, is just being afraid of the dark, because we all know that bad things happen in the dark, or what it is. So I think when it's a ubiquitous thing like that, it happens every night. Emery, what do you do?
Well, again, it's a gradual exposure issue. The thing about Halloween and the dark is more about who's going to jump out at me.
Right.
And also around things that people hear about that may be isolated events, you know, candy's going to have terrible stuff in it, you know, mm-hmm. razor blades in the apples and various things. So kids, when they hear these things, can get very frightened.
Sure.
And I would imagine, and Dr. Levine could speak to this, that children on the spectrum, you know, again, taking these things very concretely and not thinking through how to be safe for themselves, and then younger kids how to be safe, it becomes troublesome. So it can expand. It's the dark, it's Halloween, it's, you know, any situation where I'm around people who I'm unfamiliar with, and so on and so forth. So, you know, one of the things that we do is we do peer pairing. Peer pairing is whether it's with the sibling or whether it's with a kid who is just a, you know, a nice, easygoing kid that your child who's afraid can walk around with to do the trick-or-treating and such that they feel comfortable with. That's helpful. Mm-hmm. You know, and of course, parents will bring the kids around too, but to accompany them, to do it with someone who's their age that could be a behavioral model who can, without the child really knowing what they're doing, right. They're going up to the door, ringing the bell, saying trick-or-treat, you know, laughing when somebody does jump out, you know, in a fun way, mm-hmm. or something, and demonstrating just what it's like to be a kid and have, you know, Halloween candy and do the activity. That is helpful when you could have other kids who are around the same age and stuff, mm-hmm. with them, because then they can get into the fun of it, they could get into the spirit of it, and start breaking down those, you know, those fears that they have.
I think it's that modeling, too, that really does help. We do it, you know, around the Child Study Center, around Halloween, with our selectively mute kids. It's like that they have to come and they have to trick-or-treat, and they might be holding someone else's hand, and this way you want the candy. What do you have to say? Trick-or-treat. And it's so rewarding because you get candy. And if you're like me, when we were younger, that was when we lived in fear of people putting things in. So my sister and I would, like, not go home right away and just eat all the candy and then get sick, but no razor blades, just, you know. But I think, here's my question. You know, there was an advertisement on TV for some, like, haunted house, and they show these people in it absolutely terrified. How, and they wanted to do it. They were voluntarily doing it. How come for somebody, fear can be this horrible thing I want to escape from, and others are like, I hope they really scare me. How do we, can we get kids who are afraid to that point, like, I want to go in?
I often say yesterday's phobia can be tomorrow's passion. I mean, many older kids might have a passion about fire engines, and when they were young, they might have been terrified about fire engines. So often you see that evolve over time.
Yeah, and this is the thing. I mean, we talk about this all the time, in that, you know, what happens, especially as kids are aging and they get to the haunted house age, mm-hmm. you know, where mm-hmm. they want to go these things, they see their friends going to these things. Again, if they are focused on that internal sensation being one that signals, get out of here, don't go to this, you know, we have to change their understanding of the association. They have one nervous system, and one response of your nervous system can mean many different things depending on the situation. I mean, I like to tell parents, well, you know, what you're feeling during romantic encounters, in terms of the rush and the flushing and everything, you know, that is also the same experience as someone with a panic attack.
Right.
It's, you know, how are you interpreting it at the time and where you are? And we have to help kids, without using the orgasm, you know, example, but we have to help kids to understand that, you know, they have different feelings associated with situations, but some of the same physical responses can mean anger, anxiety, you know, sadness, happiness, joy, whatever.
And so it's getting comfortable sometimes with feelings, all sorts of feelings,
right.
You know.
Well, we start with feelings labeling, right?
Right.
Feeling
mm-hmm.
identification is usually one of the first steps.
That mind-body connection.
Well, and that's where I think using humor can be so effective, because it's also a high arousal feeling. It's not totally different from fear on our feelings, mm-hmm. on our feelings kind of wheel. Sometimes for trick or treat, I use the trick of making rhyming words like sticker street, snicker sneak. And again, you know, we may not think that's funny, but for the right kid, that's a riot, and it can get them laughing right at that time when they're a little afraid of getting the words out. Right.
I would have trouble saying that.
Yeah.
You're not five, right?
And that's why, Lauren, it would be funny. If you said it, we would
right.
laugh. Cause,
right,
you know.
Like a tongue twister, right? So, shifting the emotion a little, shifting the emotion one notch over from fear to funny, sometimes you can make that.
You know, here's the thing I think that, you know, I know our time is running down for you, Dr. Levine, but how do you help parents? Because sometimes it is the parents who hold the fear. Like when people walk into my office and I have like these stuffed snakes on my drawer, and like in the drawer I have a whole assortment of like dead spiders, things like that. Who knows? If you open that drawer, you'll face your fears. Parents are sometimes very concerned. They're the ones who are like, oh, I don't know, I worry. How do you help parents?
Well, yeah, I mean, I really try to make them part of the team and, again, kind of get their permission. And you really have to build trust with the parents so they know you're not going to freak out your kid. But it's just natural parenting instinct. You know, a good parent doesn't want to cause harm to their child. They don't want their child in pain. So it goes against natural parenting instinct to do this gradual exposure. And that's where doing it with somebody. You can even swap kids. Parents can swap kids with their neighbors or their sisters or something, because it's much harder to do this with your own kid, even if you know it's going to be the way to make things better, because it's very counterintuitive.
You know, it's funny. I often recommend that for parents with homework, like, you know, trade kids. But you can do the same thing with kind of fears and exposure. Sure, it's easier to do it with someone else's kid.
Right.
I think there's a portion of it that's managing a parent's own nervousness and anxiety about it, because they're really anticipating some of that anxiety for their child as well.
That's exactly, you're right on,
So, Dr. Levine, I want to thank you very much for being with us this morning. We wish you a very scary, spooky, and fun Halloween. Dr. Levine is a developmental psychologist at Helping Children with Challenges in Lexington, Massachusetts, which sounds like a great place to be in the fall. Okay.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
If I'm going to go trick-or-treating.
So
all right.
Thanks.
When we return, we're at Dr. Anne Marie